Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun, and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting, or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well. What tips do they have for you and I? And I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, and welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. This is episode 97, and we're talking about a very exciting project on the show today, a project that explores the power of positive psychological practices for improving the well-being of those struggling with mental ill health. It's very exciting. It's very new. And I'll introduce you to our guest and the powerhouse behind this project, which is a documentary, in a moment. But before I do, I want to share my three things with you. Now, you might remember, if you're a long-time or even recent listener, that prior to our last episode, which was my interview with Dr. Diana Hill about acceptance and commitment training or therapy and finding ways to get comfortable and flourish outside of your comfort zone, I'd been regularly sharing my three things. One, something I'd read or watched or listened to. Two, something I'd learned. And three, something I'd been doing to fulfill my potential. And then we had a little podcast break over Easter and for a few weeks either side. And then we returned with Diana's episode and I forgot all about my three things. And Jay, our fab producer, had to remind me. So it's a good thing she's on the ball. So I'm back for this episode with my three things. And the first of those three things is something that I've read or listened to, technically, as I've become a firm fan of the audiobook as a way to listen and learn while I'm either driving or walking. And the book I've been listening to, or I've actually just finished, has been Food Isn't Medicine by Dr. Joshua Woolrich. And if you hang out on Instagram, you might know Dr. Joshua, where he does a lot of myth busting on health related topics. And I do love a good myth busting social account. And myth busting around food forms a good chunk of this book, Food Isn't Medicine, including things like the demonizing of carbs, the challenges of a ketogenic diet and intermittent fasting, and the many, many myths that link what we eat with cancer. So he busts a whole lot of those myths, the things that you might see spruiked or circulating, particularly on social media, but also in the mainstream media. And that's all fascinating and really good stuff. I really enjoyed it. But of most interest to me in this book is his discussion of diet culture and disordered eating and just our relationship with food generally and how messy that can get. And he also includes some helpful tips on intuitive eating. And there's a whole lot of other really thoughtful conversation, thought-provoking discussion of different topics around food and our relationship with it. So it's definitely worth a read or a listen if particularly you're fascinated like me about our complicated relationships with food. Next up is something I've learned, and it's something I've learned from several of our wonderful podcast guests, particularly recently, but even going back to the early days of the podcast, people like Dr. Laura Braid, Eric Winters, Dr. Patricia Zurita Onar, and of course, our most recent interview with Dr. Diana Hill. And the conversations that I've had with each of those individuals about acceptance and making space for fear and uncertainty, but also being curious and being open to trying new things, even when they're really scary. And I've been personally putting these ideas and new skills into practice with a number of big projects that I'm working on, including the leadership program that I run here in our local community in Ballarat. In that program, we are experimenting with participant-led course content and community projects. And I know that's a challenge for the participants as well as for me. So we're all in the experimentation zone and the uncomfortable zone together. But I'm also stepping into a couple of other collaborative projects behind the scenes here at PPHQ that are new and experimental and exciting, but also kind of terrifying because they're requiring new skills of me and perhaps putting myself out there in a way that I'm not really used to. So I'm listening and learning and taking action and reminding myself that uncomfortable is okay. In fact, it's good because uncomfortable is where growth and discovery happens. And my third thing for this episode is something that I'm doing to fulfill my potential. And in fact, it's really something I'm doing as my small part to helping us all to fulfill our potential right now. And that's getting my COVID vaccine. I had my first shot about 10, 12 days ago with no ill effects. And I have my second booked for mid-June. That's the Pfizer shot, which are 3 weeks apart here in Australia. I'm aware that everyone in the world is doing this slightly differently. So that will be my second shot in mid-June. And I'm hoping that everyone listening today who is eligible for vaccination is doing the same or planning to do so as soon as you're able. It's a small thing that we can do for the benefit of all. And while we're talking about taking action, I am thrilled to introduce my guest for today's show, who along with the team at Beyond Edge is doing her bit to make a difference in the lives of so many others. Let's listen in. I am so excited to be talking to Marie McLeod today. Marie is a qualified social worker, adult education and positive psychology expert. Her work blends a deep understanding of positive psychology, neuroscience and appreciative inquiry with extensive experience in community culture change. And Marie designs and delivers sustainable wellbeing solutions for individuals and organisations and communities with a focus on activating wellbeing despite adversity. And while there are so many elements of all of that that we could talk about today, we're actually focusing on another exciting project, a documentary that she fronts called How to Thrive, in which she takes 10 volunteers with mental health issues to help them learn how to thrive. Welcome, Marie.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You are very welcome. It's delightful to have you here, and I'm really excited to talk to you about your work and about this documentary in particular and how it's come to be. I'm going to actually read the promo for How to Thrive just to kick things off and to give our listeners a sense of what it is we're talking about and why perhaps we're talking about it. So the promo is this: the world of psychology has for far too long studied what goes wrong with the human mind. Whilst these have led to important understandings around disorders, there is another side, the science of what is right about the human experience and what makes our life worth living. It's time to progress the conversation, get real about mental health, and do something positive and proactive about this massive problem. And that speaks to our mission here at the Potential Psychology Podcast so well. And so I'd love to know, before we even get into the doco piece, Marie, how did you come to know about and immerse yourself in positive psychology and the science of thriving?
Oh, well, people say that we seek to learn what we most need to know. And certainly that has been my experience. So I grew up in New Zealand, in the country, and knew from a very young age that I wanted to do things to help people in the world. And as soon as I could, you know, left home and went to see the world and returned to study social work and set about that in child protection and juvenile justice, and then moving to Australia and sort of doing that in communities. But when I had children, and I had 3 children in 2 years, one set of twins. I'm sure the maths on that is obvious, but really I unraveled, you know, like the whole, everything that I knew professionally, and I had lots of experience. I was the eldest of 5 and I left home to nanny when I was 17 in London. So I should have been well equipped for parenting. But as it turned out, I was, you know, in a situation where I was quite isolated from my family. One of my twins has high functioning autism, and what we now know is that they all have ADHD. And so in their teens, they are all kind of diagnosed and take medication every day. But it was a very tumultuous time on reflection, and I went at that time from being the professional helper to the person on the other side of the table needing to receive services. And for me, that was very confronting. But I also didn't like the approach that I was on the other end of, which I had previously been proposing, I suppose. And that was really about, so tell me what's wrong here. You know, share with me the disorder, the dysfunction, the disability even. And before I knew it, you know, I was going along to those services to receive help for my son probably particularly, and my husband was then struggling, and then we were in relationship counselling. And before I knew it, you know, the professionals were turning to me and saying, well, you're displaying a full hand of depressive symptoms. And I was like, what? You know? And so it was around that time that I heard about positive psychology, and someone had lent me the book Flourish, and I just had a bit of time one weekend when my mum was across from New Zealand. And that was the beginning for me, Alan, of, you know, starting to see that there was a different way of thinking about things. And despite the fact that we might be experiencing dysfunction and disorder, we can flip our sort of mindset and our lens, and that there's a whole realm of science and expertise out there that comes from a different side of psychology. And so I started to kind of, you know, I just read that book and I said to my husband, this personally and professionally will change my life. It's been a real kind of light bulb moment for me. So that was the beginning. And I just then started to apply it in my own life with my family, and then in ever increasing circles outward, testing what the boundaries might be. And certainly the documentary has been the biggest test of all time. But yeah, that's how it's all started.
So coming from a real place of lived experience, I suppose, is the phrase we often use, not just the academic and multiple layers in there as well. So from your own actual experience of mental health struggle, but also that piece around that, because it's something I struggle with a little bit too, the disability label around things like neurodiversity and how helpful perhaps that is or isn't. And I understand that the system's kind of set up around that way, but is that actually the best way for a family to thrive or flourish in those circumstances, or for the kids themselves to thrive or flourish?
So I don't personally, I guess I was in the era of studying social work where that was a big question. Should we diagnose, should we label people? And so I had a strong awareness about that. But to be honest, as a parent, my views are a little different now around that. And I actually really welcome a diagnosis, because it helps us to understand more clearly what we need to do about it. And, you know, I'm a very big believer that a diagnosis is a difference, not a deficit. Yeah. And that's how it is in my family, you know. Because it reminded me the other day, Mum, when you told Finn that he had autism, you told him, you know, all the other kids in the classroom have got square brains and yours is a triangle. And there's no difference between them. They just work a bit, you know. So I think that knowing what we're dealing with, and I now understand that I probably have ADHD because all my kids do. And, you know, like my brother got diagnosed in his 40s. So it's most likely. So we do have a lot of neurodiversity. And I think that that's okay, and that I sit comfortably with diagnosis. And this is certainly not about saying that we shouldn't have traditional psychology and we shouldn't be able to understand disorder, dysfunction, and all of those things and try to better navigate our lives with those. But I suppose it's about how can those things work in tandem.
That's actually a wonderfully positive nuance, really, isn't it, around that difference, not deficit. It's talking to kids, and it's something that I do with my kids all the time around the fact that, you know, we're just all good at different things in different ways, and none of them are better or worse or right or wrong. It's just the wonderful diversity that is being a set of unique human individuals, isn't
it? That's right. Yeah, I think so.
So, Marie, with that background and that experience, why a documentary? How did this come about? Before we go into what it actually looks like.
Yeah. Do you know what? It's been an interesting set of circumstances and coincidences. And the wonderful Chris Mackey, who is the clinical psychologist that runs a big clinic in Geelong, he supported me on the documentary. He's done a lot of work around synchronicity. I didn't know what that was, but there was so much synchronicity that occurred for me to be part of this documentary. You know, those things that just come towards you in life and you don't seek them out, but they throw a whole series of sliding doors come your way. And that's never been more true than this experience. So just to cut a long story short, Beyond Edge is the name of the company making the film, Dee and Andy, amazing guys that were really interested in making a documentary and to look at the idea of is there a sort of secret formula to happiness. And, you know, Dee comes from a refugee background and spent early years in refugee camps. And he noticed, I guess, that some people having his experience became resilient and optimistic and could thrive, and others really didn't. And, you know, they have succumbed to mental illness and to alcoholism and those kind of things. And he wanted to understand, is there something that helps people to be resilient despite adversity? So he was seeking to make a film like that and had come across positive psychology. And was starting to kind of talk to experts around the world. He came across me. We met each other at the World Positive Psychology Congress. And he...
Oh, wonderful conference.
Exactly. Amazing. So rich and full with all new things post-psych related. And so I told him that at that point in time, I was running a program with Headspace, our youth mental health service here in Australia, and that it was applying positive psychology with young people experiencing struggle and mental illness. And he was very fascinated and intrigued by that. And then we sort of had another alliance where someone I was coaching was interested in documentary making. But he came and listened to the young people who'd been on that program. And afterwards he said to me, "That's the documentary I want to make." And I said, "Well, you can't, because those young people are not interested in being on camera. Thanks very much." And so anyway, when that began the conversation, and there was a number of different ideas about, you know, where would we look at this? Would we look at junior doctors who have so much struggle and high rates of mental illness and workplaces and young people? And we were going to split it across kind of three areas. But in the end, we got some good advice from other filmmakers and just said, well, what happens if you just go out and engage ordinary Australians experiencing struggle and apply, you know, what you've been doing and see what happens? So that was the beginning of all that.
Mm. So this was based on a program, and we'll get into the kind of the nuts and bolts maybe a little of, you know, what is it you're actually doing with these individuals to help them to deal with the mental health struggle and the adversity that they're facing?
Yes, as I said, I had been running that program at Headspace, and previous to that, it had all started with one of the large community health services, and they knew about some other work that I had been doing in vulnerability. So, you know, I guess a lot of people in positive psychology come from backgrounds of corporate or maybe education or various different fields. But my particular area of interest and expertise is vulnerability. And having worked in child protection and having worked with disadvantaged communities around Victoria, I was particularly interested in how do we apply positive psychology where there is struggle. And so this community health service approached me and said, "We don't think we're dealing with our clients with mental health issues in ways that are evolved enough and that are making enough difference. And we wondered whether, you know, with your experience in working with people who are vulnerable and with positive psychology, would you consider making a program?" And I was in the barber shop with my kids, and I remember that call so clearly, you know, one of those defining moments when I was in equal proportions delighted and terrified by the idea. And so of course I said yes, and kind of jumped in thinking, well, how could we take the science of well-being that is so often applied when people are functioning, and the idea is then moving them from functioning to flourishing, what would happen if we took all of that research and skills and strengths and applied it when people's well-being had become suboptimal? And so, you know, I think it's important for us to sort of understand that if we have a continuum of our well-being and zero is I'm fine, and then there's zero to plus 10, my objective is I want to be better than fine. I want to think about what can help me move from that functioning being okay to flourishing. But then the zero to minus 10, which is down to surviving, and that range from zero to minus 10 where people are depressed and they're anxious and they have OCD and they have eating disorders. And traditionally they would go to a psychologist who would say, well, let's try and help those issues you have and get you back to fine. And I guess what this director of the Community Health Service was saying, what's better than that? Because it doesn't seem to be working so well. And we're working one-to-one with people, and we're having them coming back to us for years, and it just doesn't. So we decided to create a group program. And that program was called Alive to Thrive, and we began to offer it to their clients with mental health issues and, you know, fairly standard positive psychology tools that we were delivering. The whole kind of pivot was, how might that land on you if you are experiencing isolation and mental illness or grief or, you know, those kind of things? And so how can we sort of you know, nuance these things around that vulnerability. And how can we sort of say to people, your mental illness does not need to confine and define you. We want to explore that capacity of being able to dance in the rain, being able to thrive despite struggle. And that's, you know, I got very, very excited about that idea and that question. And so that's what it was. It was a 6-week program, 2 hours at a time. And it was extraordinarily successful in moving people who had tried everything else and had been around in the traps, you know, trying to deal with mental illness for a long time. And so then there started to be people sort of nipping at my heels saying, you need to do more of this, because if I had had this when I was in school, it would have changed the trajectory of my life. And so there was some grief associated for them about, how did I not know this? Because my life could have been different. I could have been more. So it was a very defining moment in my career, I suppose. And then we started to take some of those people and ask them to co-facilitate, so that we had people with that lived experience sitting alongside me. And again, another beautiful moment was when there was no longer funds, as always seems to happen, for me to continue to deliver that. I was able to hand that over to one of the earliest participants of the program, and she could run it with a member of that community health service. And the results that they got were even better than when I was there. And I love that.
Yeah. So, so many fascinating things going on there. Not only, obviously, that real experience and that feedback that you were getting from these participants, that this was making such a real difference in their lives, even though that's tied up with that little bit of grief, that lost opportunity, I suppose, for them. But you know, hopefully it means that that opportunity is there for future participants, future generations even. But then from a psychological point of view, being able to take a research body, I suppose, that's really has largely concentrated on moving people from that, you know, zero to plus 10 or even the plus 5 to plus 10. And certainly I come from a coaching background, and that's, you know, where we kind of operate is it's about not necessarily the tools and techniques. We're applying the same tools and techniques. We're just applying them to a different population. So that research had been around that, but then bringing it right back full circle and taking that research and those applications and sort of overlaying the mental health struggle with the flourishing. I hope I'm making sense.
You're making sense. Yeah.
I have this visual in my head that perhaps I'll try and write, you know, pull together for our listeners so that they can see it in the show notes. But we do, as you said, we have this mental health spectrum, and traditionally we've sort of drawn it with people struggling with mental ill health at one end and then the flourishing at the other. And it's always been a challenge, I suppose, to be able to actually describe that in a way that says just because you have the mental ill health doesn't mean you can't flourish. You know, it's not an either or, it can be both, but traditionally we haven't actually had the mechanisms for doing that. So that's exactly what you're doing here, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's not just mental health struggle. There are other kinds of struggle. It might be a physical health struggle. It might be deep grief. It might be relationship difficulties. It might be parenting difficulties. You know, there is just so much struggle. And, you know, that's, I suppose, I was sharing my starting journey, you know, that I sat in struggle for so long. And I just think myself how different things might have been had I known even just some of the smallest things to tweak my mindset and my daily routines, and the difference that that might have made for me and for my children. And I look back a little bit as well with some regret and some grief going, oh, you know, but that's life, isn't it? And I sincerely believe that the silver lining for me around that is that I honestly could not do what I do now as well as I do if I hadn't have sat and struggled so deep for so long.
Yeah.
I don't know if you, you know, can resonate with that, but I think sometimes you have to have sat in and acknowledged and really felt your own hard times.
I suppose it creates that connection and a deeper sense of empathy to have actually been there and done it, and to have a really good understanding, a real understanding of how others might feel as best we ever can when it comes to trying to be in somebody else's head.
Yes, yes.
Can you tell me then, tell all of us a little about some of the tools and techniques that you've used both in that program and now in this documentary, the sorts of things that people will see participants participating in to make a difference? And I guess what you'll be telling us will be also the things that might have made the biggest difference for you if you've been able to put them into place back in those days of struggle.
So I guess since the time when I first started this, as always happens, my thinking has evolved and, you know, we sort of get sharper and better, and then sometimes we maybe overcreate and get too much and have to kind of bring it back down. But since the Alive to Thrive days when I was sort of doing this out and trying to figure it out, one of the things that I realized was that many of us are using PERMA, which is the framework for positive psychology that Professor Martin Seligman, the founder of positive psychology, put forward. For me, I guess I found that that was not really always hitting the mark, and it was quite individualistic. And as I said, that was very much designed around you're already fine, and this will help you to be maybe weller than well, we might think about. And so I wanted to create something that was a framework that was memorable, that had metaphor, and that also scaled a little bit more that kind of me to we spectrum. And so I have created a framework called Beacon. And obviously the metaphor around that is that we want to begin to shine our brightest for ourselves, but also for others. And that if we're at a place, you know, if we're a workplace or a family or a school, then we can think about that system and that place shining its brightest, and that this framework works equally well in that way. So Beacon stands for belonging, engagement, accountability, compassion, optimism, and nurture. So I might just go through a little bit what's under each of those. And I suppose the trick is then also we have found great benefit in group programs and people being and creating a tribe and a community and knowing that they're not alone, but also where we can to have that one-to-one coaching with people so that you can have an individualized conversation with them. So the first beacon beam is belonging. And so in that, we are thinking about the fact that, you know, one of the most important things in terms of our thriving is having close connections with other people. The nuance around that is that when people are struggling, if their struggle has been deep or long, many of them are often feeling very isolated. So if you tell people who are struggling that the most important thing for their well-being is to be close connected, that can feel really tough. And so the great thing, I guess, is Professor Barbara Fridrick's research around positivity resonance means that, yes, we want to over time have close connections and enduring connections with people and to have a thrive tribe around us. But before we get there, we can make small investments in our well-being just by micro moments of connection with people that we come across as we move through our day. So that was an important spin to be able to make. So that, you know, if you don't have any family or friends at this moment, that you can begin to, you know, as you go for a walk or you buy your coffee or your groceries, just look up and catch the eyes of the person in front of you and share a positive emotion of some kind, maybe a joke or a compliment or a warm smile or a comment about the weather. And when we do that, we get a release of oxytocin. There's just a micro moment where our eyes connect and we come into a bubble with someone else. Now, the reality is that many of us, even when we're quite well, are moving too fast for those tiny moments to occur. And so reminding people to prioritise that with strangers as much as loved ones, because we also need to invest in those relationships with loved ones, because they don't just sit there like stone. You know, they need to be remade and remade. And the way that they are remade is those little micro moments. So that's one part of belonging. The other part, sort of stretching out from that, is to think about who do you have in your tribe? And really getting people to understand that they can be more intentional about that. Oftentimes when people are in struggle, they have people who are a bit toxic in their lives and they haven't been setting boundaries around that. They haven't been particularly selective about people who help them go where they want to go. And so we have a blueprint for belonging, which is called knock. The metaphor of thinking about the old days that you kind of have to knock sometimes, you know, on the door or the metaphorical door, and moving away from social media. You know, we want to kind of get back to real-time connections. And so knock is an acronym, and we have pieces under all of that that I won't go all through now. But there is, I guess, stretching out from just the traditional psychology, a lot of thinking about how do we find the tribe or the group of people that really serve us to thrive despite a struggle, and how can we begin to be more authentic about our vulnerability. The next piece is engagement, and that's really about thinking about how do we move towards feeling more purpose and meaning in our lives? How do we begin to wake up each day and thinking that I am contributing to a world larger than myself? How do I have a sense of knowing what I'm good at and love doing, and able to apply my strengths in just right ways in my life? And so under that Beacon Beam, we will have people take their Via Strength survey. And that is very instructional for me as a coach and for them as we look at how struggle may have affected their strengths. So, you know, there's a lot to talk about under there. But for example, if someone's been depressed for a while, you know, we might find things in their bottom five around hope, gratitude, zest, love, which are so important to our life satisfaction and may have been part of who they were before they were in struggle. And so typically speaking, a positive psychologist, coach or practitioner might not think about the strength survey in that way, but we need to kind of have a more nuanced understanding that what we get may have been reflected in that experience of struggle.
Yeah, I use the VR quite a lot myself, and I think it is around a little bit of that nuance of being able to know, and also to know the research around which are the strengths that we do need to make sure we're engaging, whether they come naturally to us or not, that do make a difference to our psychological, emotional well-being and the ability to thrive.
That's right. And so knowing that whilst, you know, we might use that survey and it's fantastic, you know, like a survey that took 53 social scientists 3 years to develop and is freely available, thoroughly recommend it, but there's a lot of devil in the detail. And so I think that's been, you know, a really useful way for people to begin to understand themselves more. And for some people in deep struggle, it's just about understanding they have strengths and to wear that like a coat that isn't scratchy and to kind of begin to observe then for all of us how those strengths serve us and how sometimes we've got them turned up too high or turned down too low. And so as much as we want them to discover those strengths and apply them, we also want them to tune them in ways that serve them. And so there's lots of conversations about that, you know, the classic examples of kindness too much to others and not to self, or humour in the wrong places, or honesty that becomes tactless, or, you know, overdoing kind of some of those temperance strengths so we can't move forward because we're so perseverant. So those are very useful things. The next theme is something a bit unusual, I guess, in this space, and it's accountability. And accountability, I guess, is a sort of overarching important umbrella here, because what I've experienced in working with people is that if people do the work, they make change. If they don't, they don't, you know, kind of simple. But so accountability is its whole beam now, and that's because we'll say to people, thriving is not a spectator sport. And we know and acknowledge that you're in struggle, and sometimes showing up is enough, but you will need to begin to hold yourself and others around you in your world accountable for thriving. And so we have this beautiful piece of finding the balance between grit and grace. And how do you know when you need to dig in deep and make yourself do stuff, or sometimes pull back with self-compassion and know that today this is all you've got to give? So under accountability, we spend time on vision boards and goals and grit and growth mindset. You know, what kind of mindset are you bringing here? So, you know, very briefly, that's what's under there. Compassion is the next one, and that is a combination of kindness as a well-being superpower and all the beautiful research around how incredibly powerful it is to do acts of kindness to others. But of course, having boundaries and self-protective boundaries around that, like, you know, Professor Adam Grant's work in give and take. And so we have a kindness quadrant to get people thinking about where they sit there and where they might need to move to have some boundaries around some of that. But perhaps one of the most important things in this whole framework has been self-compassion and people beginning to notice their own struggle and notice that it's not just them, that it's human to struggle, and to begin to learn to soothe themselves. And so that's an incredibly important kind of piece. And then under optimism, that's really where we look at, you know, probably one of the most traditional psychological, positive psychology pieces around understanding that our brains are wired to be at their best when we feel positive and positive emotion, so that when we feel joy, awe, hope, pride, love, serenity, that we open up and we see more and we connect better and we bounce through difficult times. And so understanding that the wiring out of our brain is actually against that, and how do we rewire it and getting people going on those activities. But also beyond positive psychology a little bit, using some CBT around the stories we tell ourselves and how do we better navigate negative emotions, because that's life, right? You know, we can give ourselves tricks and tools and things to go out into the weather and to better protect ourselves, but we can't stop the storms from coming. And so how do we better navigate those when they do come? And then finally, nurture is about our physical health. So eating, moving, sleeping, and taking time for mindfulness comes under there.
Mm. It's fascinating. And I know for me personally, one of the complexities often of, or one of the challenges of communicating the science, the work that's been done, and the impact that it can have is around distilling it down into a way that it becomes understandable and tangible. And what you have there, what you've been able to describe for me anyway, is just a wonderful metaphor, and then a series of metaphors that sit underneath there. The idea of the beacon, the beams that come from each of those, the acronym and the ability then to remember, you know, all of those explanations and the way you've beautifully put each of those, it does. It just takes something that is big and wide and deep and has many, many parts and kind of pulls it together into something really tangible. So I can fully understand, even just from listening to you, Marie, how even that could have a huge impact on a participant or on somebody learning that this is stuff you can use, it's tangible and translatable and doable, which is wonderful, and also wonderful for us as practitioners, I think, too. You know, those people who can pull it together in such a succinct way, because it's not the easiest thing in the world to do, I know, because I've tried it. So great, that gives us a wonderful sense of the framework and also the depths of the evidence that sits behind this framework that you're using in the documentary that you're actually taking these participants through. But that sort of sits in the background, I'm guessing, with perhaps the stories of these individuals being at the forefront. Mm. Would I be correct? From the promo that I've seen that we will put in the show notes so that people can have a look.
Yeah. Look, the filmmakers are doing a very good job of trying to blend those things. And we're having, they have more recently having conversations with people that create graphics. And, you know, I think one of the things that's very important for us with this documentary is that we go past awareness raising. You know, there have been very many documentaries about mental health that raise awareness. We know it's a problem, right? Yeah. What we don't know so much is what do we do about it? And if what we have been doing about it is not quite enough yet, and please, I definitely don't want to say that what's happening at the moment in terms of our clinical mental health services is not fantastic, because it is. But I guess I'm saying, is this another piece of the puzzle, and could we collaboratively offer this? So I've had a beautiful experience recently training clinicians from Headspace. So a group of people who are social workers, OTs, exercise physiologists, psychologists, centre managers, community outreach people. So they already have their own toolboxes and they are already qualified. But I guess, you know, we can never have enough tools in the tool belt. Mm. And so we've been able to kind of train those clinicians in Beacon, and then they've been able to go away and apply that with young people. And we are looking at them beginning to run groups as well in the same sort of way that I have. And that's very important, right? Because what we don't want to happen is, oh, well, we see Marie in this documentary and, you know, she did that, but that's her thing. It isn't my thing, you know. Yes, I've taken a long time, and all of my sort of worldly wisdom now that I'm over 50, you know, my worldly wisdom and also my qualifications and deep reading in positive psychology, and it's about translating that. And I am a conduit, really. But what's important to me is that I begin to be a conduit to others who can be conduits, you know, the beacons. So, you know, we can have more people who can spread this. So, yes, the participant stories are incredibly important, because if you just hear the science, it's boring. if you just hear their stories, you just raise awareness, you know. So how do we take good storytelling and blend together something that is entertaining enough, engaging enough, but also educating enough to shift the dial and get people immediately some things that get them thinking about, oh, that doesn't sound difficult. I could write down three things that went well in my day, or I could start making eye contact with a stranger and just have a little micro moment of connection, or I could, you know, focus a little bit more on getting some exercise or better sleep, or thinking about having compassion towards myself. And so the challenge for us now in the next little part while the documentary is in its final stages is to make sure that there are things that people can catch, you know, because positive psychology needs to be both taught and caught. And we can teach it, and we can teach it to people when they're well, and they might be able to catch those things like a pro baseballer or something like that. But when you're struggling, your capacity to catch what's being thrown towards you is compromised. And so that is the sort of trick, is how do we make these things bite-sized enough but also have this minimum effective dose that can start to shift the dial for people.
And am I right, Marie, in thinking that one of the, I suppose, benefits of operating in this space, you know, traditionally with psychology at least, we haven't waited, but it's been perhaps a downfall of the profession that people have succumbed to struggle and then they seek the help, and that's when psychologists are there to help and support, and obviously can make a huge difference. But I know I'm personally interested in these ways in which we can kind of scale up some of that learning and perhaps position it so that whilst in this case it's absolutely going to be of enormous benefit, that understanding, even that hope around knowing that there's something that you can do if you are in a state of struggle in some domain in your life, there's also a big preventative piece to this as well, isn't there? Yes. Am I right in thinking that that's been quite an intention around the documentary and the work you're doing?
Yes, that's right. So I think what we've probably done is go to the really hard end of the continuum to prove that it works, you know, and we've sort of had some laughs about that. The clinical psych who's on the program with us says to me frequently, the people who you have taken on with this documentary are struggling significantly more than the people that walk through my clinic every day and have for the last 25 years. So, I mean, I think and then we threw a global pandemic in, right, in the middle of about doing a marathon and then sort of someone throwing a backpack of bricks on the back. But yes, I think that what we are very interested in is how do we catch people before they have, you know, fallen into the river and they're downstream drowning. How do we catch them before they sort of falling in? And how do we preventatively build their wellbeing literacy and get things in their toolbox and tool belt that they can pull out when things start to kind of, and it might be that they have started to struggle, but they haven't yet fallen so far. It's kind of, you know, that early preventative stages. And I think that, you know, positive psychology and, for example, workplace wellbeing, which I'm sure you're involved in doing such important work in that space, Ellen, and that is preventative, and it is providing these things to people when they're doing fine. I suppose one of the things that I'm very interested in is what happens when people just start to feel like everything is not quite as it should be. You know those moments where people around you start to say, ooh, maybe you need to see somebody. Maybe, you know, this is sort of not. And they might not need to see a psychologist, and they might feel that there's a stereotype around that. They might just need a coach to get alongside them, or someone who's been upskilled, a leader or a teacher or a social worker or a family member. And, you know, you can then equip them before they. So, I mean, I'm very interested in the space. And certainly, you know, if there are people in your community who are in organisations or are practitioners that are interested in having the conversation about this or being able to use this work in their work, I think that one of the things, and I'm very open to a conversation with you about this, Ellen, because I sort of bow down to your greater knowledge, but I think that in workplaces, for example, like if you think about our society and our community, and we know how many people are in struggle, but one of the biggest institutions in our society is workplaces and schools, I suppose, that, you know, many people are in those places. And so where do we catch them? Where do we catch them in a way that they can learn this? And I think that workplaces right now, they're doing some great work in this mental health first aid and there's some workplace wellbeing stuff. But when people start to struggle, when the only option is EAP, I'm not sure that that is good enough anymore. And I'm going out on a limb here, but I am just suggesting that what is beyond EAP? What is a more evolved, intelligent EAP? And how can we better equip leaders and others that are the beacons in whatever role they're in healthcare and human services and education to be those beacons so that when they observe their people starting to not perform, not be as productive, not being as passionate, starting to kind of become less than their best selves, rather than being frightened and feeling ill-equipped and under-resourced, how can we support them firstly as the sort of first point of call, but then maybe have another parallel kind of offering? So that's something I'm very interested in terms of how do we create impact off the back of the documentary.
Yeah, and I think I'd probably take that even a step further, Marie, from my own experience and my own kind of personal passion and the work that I do in workplaces, which is around how do you actually even help the leaders to understand this stuff for themselves first? Because then they have that bit of lived experience, that ability to then be able to pass that on that is so much more meaningful. You know, I've spent a long time talking to leaders in workplaces around mental health and wellbeing and detect the signs and symptoms and what do you do and how do you have the conversation? But I'm not sure it's ever quite as powerful as, you know, how do you actually implement this stuff in your own life? And then they become much more, you know, they experience the transformation that they then become, I'm not sure that evangelical is quite the right word, but certainly proponents. Yeah. It becomes embedded in the way because so much of the sorts of things you're talking about here, the thoughts of work that I do, that you do with individuals, makes them better leaders. You know, it makes them better people and therefore better leaders. And therefore, we can actually have that thriving entire workplace environment. You know, it all just plays together so beautifully that that becomes a culture that is supportive and, I suppose, creates a vibe of preventative mental health stuff, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
It's a fantastic opportunity. And I think it's the kind of work that really lights a fire for me, having brought, because I also fully agree that we have these institutions like workplaces. In fact, I think Mark Seligman, when he first started working in this area, talked about not just the individual approach, but how do we harness education and our various systems, including our workplaces, to make this stuff livable and the everyday. So that's, you know, because of my own background in corporate, it just made sense that that would be where I would operate. And having the tools to be able to do that, to be able to do it really effectively using the stuff that you're talking about, that's where it can start to really make a big difference.
Yeah, so look, I absolutely agree with you, Ellen, that each and every one of us needs to do the work. You know, that I'm probably yet to meet someone who's never struggled, you know, in their life.
Not really human.
You know, that's right. Are they a robot? And Susan Davidson's got some beautiful quotes around this. But, you know, if you're not experiencing struggle sometimes, you're not leaning into life enough, I would say. And you know that really, if you're not struggling, then you're dead, or you're sort of just, we are designed to live a life that has us sometimes then experiencing struggle. If we love and we live and we lead, then we will struggle. And so I think that to enable a leader to find that and to have to work on that first. That's always my starting point. And you're right, when Seligman came out to Geelong Grammar, you know, which really sort of started the positive psychology movement in Australia, and they talk about learn, live, teach, embed. And certainly in my work always there's a duality around you need to learn it, live it, lead it. Or sometimes I'll use the language that you learn, you lift your own life, you gift it to others, and then you shift the place. Because there is that three layer, you know, for self and then thinking about how do I move that through to the system? Because like seed and soil, You know, I can put all the work into one person in that workplace and give them all the tips and tools. If they are a seed sitting in toxic soil, then it's very, very hard for them to grow, let alone to thrive and flourish. And so it is a responsibility, really, to think about in workplaces, how do we move through from that self to system, and that everybody is accountable for that. And so I think leaders are attracted to that part of the Beacon model as well, that accountability is there, because it is a fine line between showing compassion for people in struggle and holding them accountable for doing what they can to be their best selves.
Yeah, look, so many incredible opportunities there. So we will continue that conversation, absolutely. I'm interested, as we come to the tail end of this conversation, sadly, Marie, in where the documentary itself is at the moment. Do you have a sense of when it will hit the airwaves available for our listeners to watch and what needs to happen between now and then?
Oh my goodness, it's totally opened up my eyes to how extraordinarily difficult it is to make a documentary in this country. there are so many loopholes. The guys have been incredibly perseverant, and we have been lucky enough to secure funding from both Screen Australia and Film Victoria, and to have some distribution deals on the table. Having said that, there is quite a lot of dynamics and things to work through from legal perspectives and financial perspectives. We've also been lucky enough to get a large amount of our funding from philanthropy and have some amazing donors who remain incredibly supportive and a part of our kind of extended family. When we think about, you know, the impact that we want to create, because making a documentary is one part, right? But then you need to be thinking about how do you use that to maximize the opportunity to change people's lives.
Yeah, it's the vehicle, isn't it?
That's right. So quarter one, 2022, most likely. And at the moment there is editors and people that do graphics and people that do music and do stuff that I don't even really understand. And there is also a small amount of filming still to go, because obviously we had to film in a pandemic. So, you know, I've got cameras and microphones and things, but the guys are coming out to do some filming with me and my family in the next couple of weeks, and are back around to participants to do some things that are a bit more cinematic and a bit more interesting, because we've got a lot of, you know, Zoom and diary cam. So, yeah, we've got a small funding gap that we are still, you know, talking to some people about, and, you know, going around looking for sponsorship from corporates that might want to align. Dr. Peggy Kern from the University of Melbourne has been involved with us in terms of valuation, and our intention is to provide a free tool that will be available for everyone who watches the documentary, that they can, you know, do a QR code, like a, you know, like a COVID check-in, but they can do a QR code.
Now that we all know how to do that.
That's right. That's been a benefit. So that they can do a quick measure for themselves against the Beacon Star or the Beacon measure, and then be given that sort of light touch support, like a simple level of what we've been doing. And then if people want more, they come through to Thriveability, which is the business that I'm just rebranding to, and that will sort of sit to the side of this and continue to support people and hopefully scale it out and share it out into the world.
Wonderful. And you must have learned so much yourself through this experience.
Oh my goodness. Just so, so much, and so much personally for me going through that from home with my three children in the house and sometimes working with some people with very, very dramatic mental illness, and just thinking if people are experiencing bulimia or they're cutting or they're suicidal or whatever, and just thinking, what do I know about this? Yeah. How can I? And then just working through that and watching what happens and have it hold faith. And, you know, I guess there's one last thing that I would want to add in terms of that, and as a learning and a reflection, is just that the content is the content. And of course, there's a way of pulling it together and things like that. But more than the content, there is the way that it is delivered. And we talked about, you know, it being taught in court. But one of the things that makes a difference around that is how we deliver it, and how we build relationship and rapport, and how we create, for us, creating that group into a tribe, and to this day remain incredibly. They were together yesterday, and one of the participants' mother died the day before yesterday, and that tribe of people who were diverse, struggling Australians who are now quite knit because they have a foundation of shared vulnerability. Mm. And that I have kind of gone out on a limb around love.
Yeah.
You know, that it's a little bit frowned upon maybe, and you have to keep and check your boundaries, but we need to, if we're going to work with people in struggle, and even if we've got the best tools in the world, we need to think about how do we create that sense of psychological safety that enables people to learn.
Yeah, a sense of community and connection that, as you said right at the beginning, of that the beacon model is so critical to us.
The belonging.
And our ability, yeah, to not just survive but also to thrive.
Yeah. Thankfully, we took our participants away on a wilderness weekend before COVID hit, so they could actually be in the same room together and get some of that before COVID kind of came along. So that was a very lucky thing that happened.
Marie, thank you so much for not just sharing with us the work that you're doing, the work that you have done, the very exciting project that is How to Thrive, the documentary, but also for the work that you are doing for us as a profession, for our community, because it is, and I suppose, well, I like to think that I can appreciate the complexity only because I tried to do it myself and I know how hard it is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to have been able to forge ahead and produce this body of work, especially during a global pandemic with your children at home, is just extraordinary. And so, you know, I want to thank you on behalf of all of us listening in for that work.
Oh, look, thank you, Ellen. And it's been an absolute blessing and a pleasure for me. I feel so much gratitude, and it's been hard for me this year actually to be without that, to be honest. Like, you know, kind of a come down, you know, because it was extraordinarily challenging and challenged me out of my own skin. But what a most magnificent experience to have had and to be a part of those people's lives and to see them transform in the way that they have is just truly a dream.
Well, we'll be very excited to see what's next once, of course, this documentary is out there into the world, and we will put all of the details of it and where to find out more, including the link to the trailer that you can watch, in the show notes for today's episode. Thank you again, Marie, for everything, for being a wonderful guest, for the conversation and the insights. We really do appreciate it, and I think you've given us all a greater sense of the role that perhaps we can play in helping others around us to thrive, which I think is a wonderful gift.
No worries at all. It's been a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for sharing that conversation with Marie McLeod with me. I'm really excited to see the full documentary when it's released. But in the meantime, we can all watch the trailer for How to Thrive, A Practical Guide to Happiness, online. We've included a link in the show notes for this episode that you'll find either in your podcast player or at potential.com.au. And we've also included links to Marie's brand new website called Thrivability and the social accounts for her work so that you can learn more and make contact with her if you like. A couple of little behind the scenes notes that I'd like to make too today before I leave you until our next episode. First up, if you're enjoying the podcast and you have a particular interest in how fulfilling your potential as a person helps you to fulfill your potential as a leader, whether that's in the workplace, at home, or within your community, then I recommend you join up as a Potential Psychology subscriber. We've put the links to subscribe in the show notes for today's episode, and subscribers are notified as soon as a new podcast episode is released. You also get tips on becoming an authentic, effective individual and leader, and links to other fascinating and helpful resources that I come across in my work as a workplace psychologist. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that Potential Psychology Podcast, the Potential Psychology Podcast, is now on YouTube. You can now see us as well as hear us. And by us, I mean my guests and I as we get deep in discussion. It is a lot of fun having a visual as well as an audio, and it really gives our conversations a whole new dimension. So you can search Potential Psychology on YouTube or follow the links in our show notes. And that's it from me today. We will be back with episode 98, getting very close to that 100th episode. We'll be back in mid-June, We'll be with a new guest, a new conversation, and new strategies for becoming your best self and fulfilling your potential. I'll see you then.